I guess I'm going to start. Hi everyone, thank you for joining us. My name is Ilya Spitzer, and I'm going to be talking today about my joint work with Yehuda Perl, and the title of that paper is Complete Identification Methods for the Causal Hierarchy. First slide, please. So, we're going to be talking about formalizing and answering causal questions that people ask. And the motivation for this is, I'm sure, familiar to most members of this reading group. People, of course, ask causal questions all the time, both professionally and in everyday discourse. And not only that, they seem to form consensus of what causal statements and questions mean. So when people say that carbon dioxide causes global warming and smoking causes cancer, we sort of all agree on what that means. But despite this consensus, people seem to use sort of intuition when talking about causality. And the advantages of formalizing these intuitions mathematically, of course, are that intuitions can fail. And not only that, but by using a more formal language, it is possible to talk about and ask questions that are not natural to ask if you restrict yourself to natural language. And finally, by going to a formal language, it is possible, or you're forced, in fact, to explicitly list the assumptions that you need to answer causal questions. And of course, these assumptions are made anyways, and people ask and answer these questions informally. But there is much to be gained by explicitly listing them. So, the general high-level question that we address is in this paper is what sorts of assumptions are necessary to answer causal questions that people care about. And in particular, we look at a more specific question. Given a particular causal question, what specific assumptions are needed for that question alone? And finally, we consider if it's possible to develop a general method for answering causal questions. And if such a method is possible to be developed, is it possible to say something about the generality of this method? What kinds of questions can it answer in principle? Next slide, please. Now, the questions that, the notions we will formalize are as follows. We will talk about graphical causal models. That will be the framework which we will use, and our causal domains will be these models. We will formalize changes in the domain as interventions, and I guess changes are important because one can think of causality or causal inference as formalizing responses to change. And we're going to consider two kinds of causal queries. The first query is the causal effects, which are responses to a particular change or a set of changes. And the second query is the counterfactual, which is responses to multiple potentially conflicting hypothetical changes. And I'm going to talk later about the specific distinction between these queries. And finally, we will formalize what it means to answer questions of this type, and that will be the process known as identification, or I like to call it causal induction, which is just reasoning from premises to evaluate these questions. And I call it causal deduction. And I call it that because it's very similar to logical deduction, which is just reasoning from premises using formulas and some logical language. The only difference here is that instead of formulas, we use probability distributions. But the basic idea is the same. Next slide, please. So this is the standard definition of graphical causal models. It is probably familiar to most people here. It is just a tuple containing a set of observable variables, a set of background variables which cannot be observed but which influence the things that we can see in our domain. We have a set of functions which represent causal mechanisms. And there is one causal mechanism for every observable in our model, which determines that observable in terms of other variables in the system, either is themselves observable or hidden. And finally, we represent uncertainty of our domain by having a probability distribution over the background variables, which is not generally known. And this distribution P of U, together with the functional causal mechanisms, induce a distribution P of V over observable variables, which we do have access to. That leads to assumption. Next slide, please. Now, the nice thing, the models are called graphical, of course, because they induce causal graphs. And the nice thing about graphs is that it's very easy to read off what it is that the model is saying in graphs, and it's much much more intuitive for people to look at a graph than to look at a bunch of equations, although in some sense they encode equivalent information. And you construct a causal graph from a model in a very simple way. You have a vertex for each node, whether it's for each variable, whether it's an observed variable or a hidden variable, and you connect, make one variable apparent to another if that variable appears in a mechanism which determines the child. And finally, intuitively what you want is you want to have a bidirected arrow between background variables that are dependent. But for technical reasons I don't really want to get into now, the definition is kind of backwards. In fact, it is the absence of such arcs between sets of background variables, which implies that those sets are marginally independent. So, and as an example, there are two graphs on the slide. On the left, we have the sort of classic smoking cancer graph. You have smoking, which is the propensity to smoke, which we can measure, and this determines propensity to get lung cancer. And both of these variables are influenced in turn by some background variables we don't really have access to. And we can postulate that these background variables are themselves correlated via some genetic factor, maybe a propensity for addiction, also influences your resistance to developing lung cancer, something like that. That's represented by a bidirected arc. And one way of thinking about these arcs is it just represents some hidden common cause. And on the right, it's a very similar graph, except that there is, in addition, an observed mediating node between smoking and cancer, and we assume that cancer is developed by means of tar deposits in the lungs. And these tar deposits, in turn, are influenced by some unknown stochastic process represented by U2. And moreover, this process is independent of the processes that influences smoking and influences cancer formation. And that's represented by the fact that U2 does not have a bidirect arc connecting to either U1 or U3. And finally, the way these graphs are drawn, you could, without loss of generality, assume that each U has at most one observable child. And in that case, it's possible to just drop the U's and draw a bidirected arc between observable nodes whose U parents are dependent, and otherwise to just drop the U's entirely. So if you go forward one, you will see what this graph looks like if the U's are dropped. And next slide, please. Now, the nice thing about graphs is that you can read off independent structure of the observed probability distribution using the well-known notion of fast blocking called deseparation. And this is, of course, the standard definition of deseparation, slightly extended to account for the fact that we have bidirected arcs. Essentially, two variables are independent if all possible paths from one variable to another are blocked. Where blocking is defined using these two conditions. And you can block things by conditioning. So if you have a causal chain from X to Y through W, and W is conditioned on, then that constitutes a block. And similarly, if W is a common cause of X and Y, and there's also a third case involving bidirected arcs. So I won't spend too much time on this slide. This is probably very familiar to everyone. And we'll come back to deseparation later on. Now, next slide. We consider in these graphical causal models kinds of queries. The first is the causal effect, and the example here is the following. I have a headache, and I want to know if I should take medicine or not. And in some sense, the decision to take the medicine we model by viewing it as kind of a change imposed on the system from the outside. And they're interested in what will happen to an outcome variable of interest after this change was imposed. And the second kind of query is the counterfactual query. And the example is, would I have a headache had I taken an aspirin? And the difference, these queries kind of sound similar, but there is a crucial difference between them. In the case of counterfactual, you're implicitly talking about two situations at once. Namely, there is a situation that I find myself in now where I have a headache and I did not take an aspirin. And I'm asking about some hypothetical world where somehow history was altered and aspirin was in fact taken. And I'm interested in the outcomes there. And the crucial difference between these kinds of queries is that in the counterfactual case, because you have these multiple worlds, these worlds can have conflicting evidence in some sense, or conflicting state of affairs. Whereas in causal, in questions of causal effects, conflict never arises. And I will later on talk about exactly what this conflict entails, how to formalize this. Next slide, please. So we model these, in order to model these queries properly, we need to have the notion of intervention, which is how we model change. And an intervention is written 2x, and it sets a set of values x to some values, regardless of the natural causal influences on f. So here we have two causal graphs again, and there are two example interventions here. In the graph on the left, we kind of do an immoral randomized experiment where we draw people at random, put them in a room, and make them smoke, regardless of what their natural predilections are for smoking. And then we might ask what their cancer incidence rate would be. And on the right, it's a similar sort of thing. We make sure that the patient does not have tar in their lungs by, if necessary, performing surgery and actually removing them, removing the tar deposits. And we define the causal effect of DUX on the rest of the variables in the system using the notion of an interventional distribution, which we write by putting X in a subscript or by putting it the DUX behind the conditioning bar. And there are some other notations as well, of course. Graphically speaking, you can think of an intervention as removing all arrows incoming to X to create a submodel M sub X. And the reason you do that is because when you fix a value to a variable to a particular value, regardless of what it would naturally do, you kind of ignore the typical causal influences on this variable. And these causal influences come from the parents. And you kind of denote that by removing all the arrows from those parents. Next slide, please. Now, we can use interventions to define counterfactuals from atomic counterfactual events on a single variable, and we denote them with a subscript after the variable and a value. So, for example, event capital Y sub X equals little y means variable Y attains value little y under intervention 2X. And sometimes the abbreviated is just little y sub X. And we view counterfactual questions as conjunctions over these kinds of events. And each such event takes place in its own submodel. So for example, our headache aspirin example contains two events. There is, in one world, no aspirin was taken, so that's just aspirin contains value no. And in another world, we're interested in a distribution over the headache, given that we kind of went back in time and fixed aspirin to yes, we decided to take aspirin. And so our query can in fact be represented as a distribution over these events. So it's really a probability of headache given that we decide to take aspirin and given that no aspirin was actually taken. So it's kind of an odd phrasing for this. And I think it even looks odd because it has kind of a conflict of values between two worlds. Nevertheless, despite this conflict, this is a well-defined distribution. It's derivable from the model, and in fact, it usually this probability is not usually zero. Next slide, please. Now, there are two direct methods of evaluating causal queries. Now, if we know the exact causal mechanisms in our model, and if we know the distribution over the background variables, we just know everything about the model. Essentially, we can evaluate any query that follows from the model. If we don't know that, we could actually act in our domain or perform a randomized experiment if we have populations involved, and directly measure the outcome to get the causal effect. The problems, of course, are that we generally don't know the causal mechanisms, like we don't know the exact functional description of how cancer forms, of course, not to that level of detail. And we certainly generally don't know the distribution over use, because by definition, use are not observed. Experiments are often expensive or illegal to conduct, like we can't make people smoke. Actual surgery, and to remove the tar is expensive. And it's often not clear what to do with counterfactuals. The reason being that because counterfactuals have conflict, it's not clear what experiment we should be performing to evaluate them. Like, our counterfactual on the previous slide involved both taking aspirin and not taking aspirin. It's not clear what that means exactly. So we want to find a way to compute queries from causal assumptions and available information. Next slide, please. And the process by which we do that is called identification, or I like to call it causal deduction. And we write phi identifies data in T, written with that little probability symbol there. If data can be uniquely computed from phi in a class of models described by P. And we say that phi does not identify theta if there exist two models, M1 and M2, in our model class, such that these models agree on phi or disagree on theta. An intuition here is that phi are sort of premises or axioms. P is the domain theory that we're interested in, and theta is the query. So the example in mathematical logic is we want to see if we can prove the axiom of choice from other axioms of set theory. And in that case, we would show that this axiom is sort of extraneous. And it turns out that this axiom cannot be so proven, and this was shown essentially by exhibiting these two models, M1 and M2, such that these models agree on the other axioms of set theory, but in one of them, the axiom of choice was true and the other was false. Now, I'm glossing over a lot of details here. It's actually a little more complicated than that, but that's the basic idea. Next slide, please. Now, in our domain of causal inference, we're not dealing with complicated infinite first-order models. Our models or our domain theories are just graphs. So it's all models that induce a particular causal graph. And our queries are just causal effects and counterfactuals. And we consider two versions of identification problem. The first is computing causal effects from observation. So we're given some information summarizing the statistical behavior of our model represented by the distribution over the observable variables, P of V. And we also have some causal assumptions represented by the causal graph G. And we're interested in computing some causal effect, the effect of X and Y, except that we also potentially add a conditioning in V. And what that means is that this is just a causal effect in a subpopulation. For example, the effect of smoking on cancer in young males or people over 65. That's a very reasonable thing to ask. Just a slightly more general version of the problem. So that's causal effect from observations. And the second problem is computing counterfactuals from experiments. So here we have gamma and delta are conjunctions of counterfactual events. We're also given the graph as before, but instead of observations, we're sort of given all possible experiments we can perform in a given model, and that's just represented by the set of we iterate over all possible subsets we can have, and we look at the effect of intervening in those variables to those subsets on the rest of the model. And I'm going to say later a little bit as to why we formulate the problem in this way, like why don't we just do it from observation. Next slide, please. So both of these identification problems actually receive some attention in literature, but no complete solutions exist. And our contribution is complete algorithms for both of these problems. And completeness here means that if our algorithms fail, then all other methods must also fail. In other words, if they fail in a particular query, then that query is actually not identifiable. We can explicitly prove it. And completeness allows us to derive some useful corollary. Next slide, please. First is a complete graphical characterization of identifiable causal effects. And what that means is that if you give me just a graph, I can, and a particular effect that you want me to identify, I could, by looking at the graph, tell you whether it's identifiable or not. And if it is identifiable, what the expression for it should be, just by looking at the graph, without talking about any of the numbers in the probability distribution associated with this graph. We can use our results to establish completeness status of existing identification algorithms, for example, Jean Tian's algorithm, and through calculus, which can be viewed as a declarative algorithm for identification. I'll talk about through calculus later. And the applications include surrogate experiments and identifiable models. Identifiable models just means a model in which every causal effect is identifiable. And in fact, we have a nice, easy graphical characterization of these models. And surrogate experiments just means we're interested in the causal effect of something, but we're not allowed to perform the experiment we want. Instead, we're allowed to perform some other experiments. So for example, we are interested in the effect of smoking on stress levels. But of course, we can't make people smoke. But perhaps we can use a proxy experiment by giving people a nicotine patch instead, because we have reasons to believe there is the nicotine that affects stress. And so in that sense, we may be able to derive the effect of smoking by considering an alternative experiment. And that's why it's called a surrogate experiment. And you can use these results to solve this alternative identification problem as well. And as a sort of longer-term thing, I just wanted to give a little plug for our AAAI paper this year. The graph induces certain constraints on the observable distribution. And all these constraints, of course, are conditional independence constraints. But some of them are not. And it turns out that among constraints that are not conditional independence based, there is a very nice characterization of them in terms of independencies that arise in interventional distributions that are identifiable. Unfortunately, I don't have time to go into that more, but if you are in Chicago this year and going to AAAI 08, we'll be giving a presentation on that topic. Next slide, please. So I'm going to quickly go over some existing ways of identifying effects. And these are well known. This is the famous Dagger criterion. And the idea is in this graph on the bottom, we want to identify the effect of X and Y. And the intuition here is that we're interested in the influence that X has on Y, but only along the direct causal path. So here, X influences Y along this direct path from X to Y, and also along this other sort of confounding path through C and through the bidirected arc. And what we want to do is we want to somehow block this path. And the way we do that is using these separations, we just condition in Z. So we just sum over all values of Z and condition. And once we do that, essentially conditioning becomes the same as intervening, because influence can only flow forward along the causal path. And so you get this formula on the right-hand side. And it turns out that you can apply this formula whenever Z is not a descendant of X, and Z blocks all paths from X to Y that starts in, with an arrow into X. Next slide, please. Now, Next is, of course, the Bandura criterion, which works in a similar vein, but here we're interested in the effect of X and Y in the graph on the bottom, where X is, sort of has this compounding link to Y, and you can't observe anything in this link. And it may perhaps be surprising, but you can actually identify this effect in this graph as well by essentially breaking up the effect of X and Y into two parts, the effect of X and Z, and then the effect of Z and Y. And you kind of combine them together by multiplying. And it turns out the effect of X and Z is just easily identified as the conditional distribution of Z and X. And the effect of Z and Y can just be identified by the backdoor criterion. And you kind of combine these two together, and you get the expression on the right. And there are three conditions that you can list where which allows you to use this trick. Next slide, please. There is also, in some graphs, of course, you cannot identify the causal effect, no matter how hard you try. And the simplest such graph is the so-called bow arc graph. It's pictured in the bottom there. It looks like a bow. That's why it's called that. And I'm going to quickly sketch a proof of how of non-identification, just to give an idea of how these proofs go. So I'm going to exhibit, I'm going to actually construct for you two models that agree on observational distributions but disagree on the effect of X and Y. So if you go forward one, we're going to assume that in both models U is a fair coin, so 50-50 chance, and in both of these models X is equal to U. Forward one. And the models differ by the function of Y. In the model on the left, M1, Y is just equal to the bit parity function of X and U. And in the model 2 on the right, Y is just a constant zero function. And of course, because X is equal to U by construction, the bit parity function always returns zero. So observationally speaking, these models, you can't tell them apart. Next, if you go forward one, and once more, the trick is that bit parity is observationally the same in the constant zero function, and but if we fix X to a particular value, then we kind of destroy the link between X and U, making them the same variable. And so as soon as we do that, the models on the left and on the right give us different conclusions about Y, because Y just stays zero on the right, but on the left, it starts varying with U. And the conclusion is that the effect of intervening in X cannot be identified in this graph. Next slide, please. Now, aside from these effects, aside from these conditions, there's a nice result due to Jin Tian. He derived this in 2002. And that is, he has a complete condition for determining the effect of a singleton X intervention on the rest of the variables in the model. And it turns out that such an effect can be identified if and only if there does not exist the structure pictured on the bottom, where X is connected to its child by a bidirected path. In other words, a path consisting entirely of bidirected arcs. And the nice thing about, of course, this result is that it's if and only if. And so the question one of the questions that we tackled in this paper is, what about if X and Y are just arbitrary sets? If we completely characterize when these when the causal effect problem can be solved. This is, I guess, in a sense that people have been thinking about effects in graphs. This has been open since the 50s. Next slide, please. These are the rules of Du calculus. If you've never seen them before, they might look a little scary, but actually they're very simple. They're just codifying the relationship between observational distributions and interventional distributions. The first rule just says that if you have some interventional distribution, then the separation in the graph where all the arrows incoming to intervention nodes are taken out, that the separation in that graph entails independence, which is what we want. So the graph is appropriate. Graph is Markov relative to the appropriate distribution. The second rule just says that essentially talks about that observations and interventions are equivalent if there is no confounding. In other words, there are no backdoor paths, which we already talked about when discussing the backdoor criterion. And rule three just says essentially enumerates which effects are exchanging And the question is, given that you are allowed to manipulate your causal effect expression using rules of probability, and using these three rules, is it possible to massage it algebraically such that all of the subscripts disappear? And if you do that, of course, that would mean that this causal effect is identifiable. So can you identify every causal effect using this, these kinds of manipulations? And that's been open since Dukakis was proposed in 94. Next slide, please. So our result is a complete graphical condition for identification in the general case of the effect of a set of x on the set of y. A complete algorithm expressing this effect if it's identifiable in terms of the observed distribution P of B. A proof of completeness of the calculus for identifying this general case. And the characterization of models where all effects are identifiable. Next slide, please. So I'm going to quickly go over in a little more detail about how the general algorithm works. And this is most of this work is due to Jin Tian. He was the one who developed the first complete algorithm for this problem, although he didn't fully complete. The key structure turns out to be the notion of decomponents, and that's the maximal set of nodes pairwise connected by bidirected paths. So in the graph on this slide, we have five nodes, and we have two C components. The first is just X and Y, because they're connected by an arc. And the second is W, C, and M. Two of them are connected by arcs, one of them is connected by a bidirected path. Next slide, please. It turns out that if we intervene in X, we take out the arrows incoming to X. And in the remaining graph, we look at the C components. And each of these C components turns out to correspond to an identification sub-problem. And to identify the effect of X and Y, what we want to do is we want to identify the effect of on every C component of all the variables not in that C component, and return their product, marginalizing out all the variables we don't care about. So to make that concrete, here we have an example graph, and we're interested in the effect of X and Y. If we take out all the arrows pointing to X, we have two C components. One is W and Z, and the second is just Y by itself. And each of those C components corresponds to a subproblem. So the first is just the effect of Z and Y, and the second is the effect of X on Z and W. And we want to solve each of those problems, multiply the results together, and sum out variables W and Z, since we don't care about them. And although it may seem like we made it harder for ourselves, because we had one identification problem, but now we have two. It turns out that by splitting things up according to key components, we'll make it easy for ourselves graphically. Next slide, please. In particular, it turns out that each of these sub-problems can just be elementary solvable, the first by the back door, and the second by just a theorem used with Jin Tian, again. And by combining these two solutions, we get this rather complicated expression on the bottom there. Next slide, please. Now, it turns out that this algorithm, this general method fails, or at least we don't know what to do in a situation where you're identifying a subproblem where the entire y is a C component, and y together with x is also a C component, and some x is relevant to y. In other words, it's ancestral to y. And the key theorem for completeness is that if you have this kind of failure in any subproblem, then the overall effect is not identifiable. And the proof is by explicit counterexamples, like it was in the Boark case. And as a sanity check, it's not hard to verify that the Boark graph is a special case of this condition. Next slide, please. So we also consider the version of this problem for conditional effects, where the likelihood of the outcome may be altered by also observing something, not just doing. So this is the notion of a conditional effect, so the effect of smoking and cancer in young adults. And it's just defined in a standard way by division and marginalization. I should remark that in general, interventions in conditioning do not commute, although they do if Z is not a descendant of X. Next slide. And the main result for this kind of identification is that we can find a maximum subset of the variables we condition on, such that we can discover it in polynomial time, and all the variables in the subset can be moved freely behind the conditioning bar and subscript. So it doesn't matter whether you condition on them or intervene on them. And moreover, the conditional effect is identifiable if and only if this other effect on the right is also identifiable. And the thing to notice about the effect on the right is that it involves this subset W, and it's actually unconditional. There is no conditioning bar there. And what that means is that because we have a completed algorithm for unconditional effect identification, and because this this statement is if and only if, unconditional identification is all we need, and we get completeness for free for conditional effect. Next slide, please. Now, next we will consider the problem of identifying counterfactuals. So counterfactuals, as I talked about earlier, involve multiple worlds with possibly conflicting settings of variables. So our axioms will be the set of all experiments we can perform in a single world, which is just which we call P star, and it's just we iterate over all possible subscripts. And in posing the problem in this way, computing counterfactuals from P star, we kind of separate two sets of difficulties, going from the observed distribution P of V to P star, which is handled by the causal effect identification problem. And secondly, going from P star to counterfactual distribution, which is what we're going to handle now. And of course, it's always possible to combine these together to obtain identification of counterfactuals from observations, if necessary. Next slide, please. So first things first, we need a way to display causal assumptions across multiple worlds, just like we have a causal graph for the causal effect problem. And the first attempt to do this was the so-called twin network graph, and this is due to Balkin and Perl. So here is, on the bottom on the left, we have the aspirin headache domain. And on the right, we have a kind of graph where we have a copy of this causal graph for each hypothetical world. In the world on the left, aspirin was not taken, and the world on the right was. Now, when we talk about counterfactuals, like would I have a headache had I taken an aspirin, what we're also implicitly adding to that sentence is, had I taken an aspirin, but everything else stayed the same. At least that seems to be the way people interpret these statements. And we formalize this appendum, that everything else had stayed the same, by essentially forcing these multiple worlds to share histories. In other words, to share all the unobserved views. So in this graph on the right, we have the U variables of headache being shared. And the reason we don't share the U variables of A is because, as you recall, in one of the worlds, we decide to take an aspirin, so there is an intervention there. And interventions take out incoming arcs. So one of the bidirected arcs is missing. Of course, the problem with the twin network graph is that there are only two worlds, and you can easily imagine situations where there is more than two. Next slide. So the obvious solution is to add more worlds. And then you get something called the parallel worlds graph. So for example, we can augment our domain by considering the compliance problem. So you have the prescription, and you get some medicine if you're prescribed it, and you can take it, and it will affect your symptoms. That's the graph on the left. And on the right, we can study, we could pose the question of whether there is any latent influence between the desire to get a prescription for a pain and the occurrence of the pain itself. And the way we can do that is we can consider three three experimental groups. One of the groups, you're forced to take the medicine, and one of the groups, you're forced not to take it. And the third group just behaves naturally, and we're interested in what would happen to those members who actually decide to take aspirin. And so here we have three worlds, but the problem is that distinct nodes in this graph, this complicated graph with three copies, distinct nodes can be the same variable. So for example, the three prescription nodes at the top, they all share the same function because it's just a functional copy, and they share the same U. And that means they're essentially the same random variable. And it's not convenient for a number of reasons to have a graph with this kind of duplication. For example, it makes deseparation counterintuitive to use. Next slide, please. So our solution is to get rid of inductively the parallel world graph of duplicate nodes, starting from the root. And the result is that you obtain something called the counterfactual graph. So here we have three graphs on the slide. The graph on the left is the original causal model graph. The graph in the middle is the parallel world graph. And the graph on the right is the counterfactual graph where we merge all the prescription nodes. And it turns out also that the aspirin and the headache nodes in two of these worlds are the same, because in one world we force aspirin to be taken, and in the other world the aspirin was taken freely. And the reason the two headache nodes are also the same is because if the use are fixed to be the same, then it doesn't matter whether you observe or fix. And that's the content of the action of composition, if you're curious. At any rate, you get this much smaller counterfactual graph, and the key thing to notice about this counterfactual graph is that it's just another kind of causal graph. And so all the theorems that are developed for causal graphs hold in this case as well. In particular, next slide, please. In particular, we can just solve the identification problem using this counterfactual graph in the same way by decomposing the problem into subproblems based on key components in the counterfactual graph. And the testing conditional counterfactuals, where you have gamma and delta conditioned on delta, where gamma and delta are sets of events, it's similar to testing conditional effects. And the only, I guess, one of the differences is that the failure case is slightly different. And you fail when essentially your conjunction or the variables confined to the conjunction form a key component in the counterfactual graph, and there is, in some sense, a conflict of values. And if it's an entire key component, then this conflict cannot be resolved. And the key theorem is that failure in any subproblem of this type implies that the overall counterfactual is not identifiable. Next slide, please. So here's an example of the effect of treatment on the treated. So this is the general form of the aspirin headache counterfactual we talked about earlier. So you can think of this as the effect of smoking and cancer in a subpopulation that chooses not to smoke. And that's a perfectly meaningful thing to want to ask, because perhaps the subpopulation differs in some significant way from the general population. And it turns out that this counterfactual cannot be identified in the Boas graph, but if there is an extra mediating variable that's observed, like in the Frondor graph, in this case it's D, then it turns out that it is identifiable. And so on the right we have the corresponding counterfactual graph. And using some algebra, which unfortunately I don't justify here, but essentially it's just decomposition along key components, it turns out that you get this very simple expression. And in fact, you can go further. And so first we express this counterfactual in terms of experiments, but it turns out that in the Frondor graph, all experiments are identifiable. So you can express this counterfactual just in terms of the observational distribution. You get this very simple expression at the end. Okay, and next and final slide. So the conclusions are that we use the framework of graphical causal models to pose two causal deduction problems: how to evaluate causal effects from observations and how to evaluate counterfactuals from experiments. And we gave complete algorithms for solving these problems and characterization, graphical characterization of models where a given problem can be solved. And that's it. That's my talk. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, Ilya, for this very interesting presentation. And we can now take a few questions. I hope we haven't lost our audience.
Can I ask a question about the formalism? I'm unclear about the relationship between your graphs with the double-headed arrows and Richards and Spurti's similar graphs, which they call ancestral graphs. Are they essentially the same?
No, not entirely. Richardson and Spurti's forbid the Frondor graph from existing. Right. I'm not entirely sure why they do that. I should really ask them about this. Obviously, a lot of the same theorems hold in both graphs, but I think forbidding the Frondor graph is kind of, I don't think that's a good idea, because very frequently that's exactly the pattern of causal inference that you see. Now, I think, like, as best as I could tell, they just forbid that gap from occurring just because it makes things easier to prove, not because it's particularly warranted in practice. However, some of the things of that of the ancestral gap formalism are nice, like the way one represents selection bias by having undirected nodes, because if you have selection bias at the leaf, then all the ancestral nodes become essentially correlated, and they just model that as a big undirected graph component. So perhaps it's possible to at least introduce the ideas, their ideas for handling selection bias into the semi-Markovian graph sort of framework that you're using, while still allowing Frandl graphs.
I could follow that up. All the unobservable variables in your formulation are, they don't have any observable parents. Now, if you had a sort of more general idea with unobservable latent variables, there's no reason they shouldn't have observable parents. Do you think you could cope with that in your formulation?
Right. So this is actually something I glossed over. In fact, there is a theorem due to Verma that if you have an arbitrary pattern, let's say you have a causal model, which is just a directed acyclic graph without any bidirected arc, and we pick and choose some of these nodes in this graph to be unobserved arbitrarily, then it turns out, so some of these unobserved nodes will have parents that are observed. But it turns out that for any such graph, there is an equivalent graph of the form that I'm talking about, which only has bidirected arcs, which preserves the set of independencies, at least the set of independencies that can be determined graphically. So in some sense, and that's called the latent projection. And so in some sense, there is no loss of generality, as far as I know, from just talking about bidirected arcs. Well, that's not entirely true. There are some constraints. But there are some constraints that perhaps you may need to, for example, have an unobserved variable with more than two children. So you can't really have bidirected arcs. You need, like, hyper edges or something. But, yeah, for our purposes, for just dealing with conditional independence, bidirected arcs should be sufficient. I'm not sure that answered the question.
Yeah, I think I have a somewhat related question. In your formalism, you make a distinction between variables that are known by but unobservable and variables that are purely unknown.
Right. Well, I'm sorry.
I can't hear you.
Hello? Hello, how about now?
Okay, yes.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Did you hear the question?
I heard the first part of it. You said there is a distinction between variables that are purely observed and variables that are hidden, and that's all that I heard.
Okay. So in first of all, in the formalism that you present, you assume that the graphs are known and you do inference on the graphs, right?
Right.
So do you make a distinction between variables that are purely unknown, so they are not in the graph in a way, right, the way you represent it, and variables that are known but not observed, or not observable?
I don't understand the distinction between purely, like, you mean they are known in the sense that you don't even know where in the graph they should go?
Right, yes. You know that there is a variable there, but you can't observe it. For example, you would know, you know, that there is a tumor in a certain organ, but you wouldn't be able to observe it unless you would do surgery, so most of the time you would not see it.
I'm trying to understand the distinction between an unobservable variable and a variable that's unobserved and unknown. So is it the case that you have a graph, but there may be some arcs you haven't accounted for? Is that what you mean?
No, a variable that is unknown is you know, a hidden latent variable that you may not know of at all, right? It's there. You need to account for its possible existence. But you don't know of it. I guess in your framework you don't have that case because you're not learning the graph from data anyway. So.
Well, I can say something about this question though. You could have the case where you have a graph and you want to test whether the arcs in the graph are correct or not. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So for example, it may be that you have some graph, but maybe some bidirected arc shouldn't be there. Right? Like maybe it's imaginary. And it's actually possible to test for such arcs, and I think in our IEEE paper we talk a little bit about that. So it's kind of possible to bootstrap a little bit. So if you have some causal assumptions, it's possible to test certain other causal assumptions. I think it would be a very interesting problem to figure out how to identify from nothing. So you don't even have the graph, you just have the observed distribution, and you first want to do some causal induction and infer some sort of representation of possible graphs that could have given rise to this data, and then using that representation, try to see if you can identify something. And there have been some attempts to do this, but I don't think there is a good general solution to this yet.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this sounds very interesting. I'm wondering, you know, for practical cases, how often do you know the graph to an extent that you can do inference like that and derive results that are meaningful?
Well, I can tell you from my experience. I mean, I am doing a bioinformatics postdoc now. And there, people very much care about causal effects. Like, for example, they're interested in the genetic basis of some disease. They're interested in which mutation actually causes disease.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the way mutations happen, you don't know the graph exactly, but you know enough of the graph to, for example, know that you can apply the backdoor criterion to solve the problem. The problem in practice, it seems to me, is not that you don't have enough causal knowledge to apply identification. It's the fact that you have so few samples. Like, I mean, all these results are large sample results, right? We assume like a billion samples, so we get the joint distribution exactly. But of course, in practice, like in bioinformatics, you have maybe 100 individuals, so that's 100 samples. And if you have 100 samples, you can't just naively use these methods. You have to do various statistical tricks to do the backdoor criterion. So because in the backdoor criterion, you know, you're adjusting for Z, but if Z is like 10 variables and they're binary, that's 2 to the 10 cells, and you will not have nearly enough samples to populate the distribution to that many cells. So you need to have some clever parametric form for these distributions to be able to draw meaningful conclusions. So I think causal knowledge is actually surprisingly not as much of a problem as I thought. It's the finite samples that kills you.
So are you working on an algorithm that incorporates learning from empirical data?
Yes. So we So our paper in the IEEE is on characterizing certain Verma constraints in terms of conditional dependencies in identifiable interventional distributions. And our goal is to develop an algorithm in the style of FTI, Virtus's FTI, that searches not only over conditional dependencies, but also over Verma constraints. And we hope that these additional constraints will allow us to pin the graph down enough that we'll be able to do some meaningful identification. And that'd be kind of nice.
And
but this is all in the future. I mean, I shouldn't promise things they can't deliver.
Well, no, but that gives us an idea, you know, of where this is heading towards. And I was really interested in knowing whether, like you said, in practical applications, like in bioinformatics, whether you can derive interesting conclusions with this formalism, and whether there are, you know, whether in practical cases you don't have, you know, some a nasty graph that you wouldn't be able to deal with.
I mean, the nasty graphs are a problem. I mean, in epidemiology, they're usually nasty because you can just say that everything is confounded. So, I mean, I don't want to say that it's not a problem. Actually, in this sense, bioinformatics is nice because it's much nicer to deal with cells than with people. Because in human populations, there are all sorts of confounding things going on. I agree. So it is a problem.
And computationally, could you comment on, you know, how big graphs are practically possible to handle?
Oh, the algorithms are polynomial. like I haven't. They're definitely quadratic, and they may even be better than quadratic, but it's just that I haven't bothered optimizing it or using clever data structures. Right, it's just pseudocode at this point. So, but I guess it might be an issue if we talk about bioinformatics. You know, some of their graphs are pretty big, so I may actually end up having to give an optimized version, and maybe you could get it down to end again using clever engineering. But I haven't thought about this.
So perhaps, you know, another question, unless somebody else has a question, I shouldn't really be holding the microphone all the time. Anybody else has a question?
I guess the both questions I wanted to ask.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're very quiet, I can't hear you.
Was there a question that we couldn't hear?
Yeah, there was. I think somebody was talking, but I couldn't hear them.
I don't know.
One thing, I think you've addressed it completely, but I just want to confirm. When you introduce a sort of counterfactual queries, you talked about, would I have a headache if I hadn't taken aspirin? But really the counterfactual query isn't that. It's would I have a headache if I hadn't taken aspirin, and given that I did take aspirin and I now have a headache. In other words, you have to condition on the actual outcome as well as the change in the intervention. That doesn't. I don't think that causes any problem for you, but can you just confirm that?
Yes. All right. A lot of these, I think a lot of the trouble with these counterfactuals is just how to translate things that people actually say in practice, where they don't bother listing all the implicit assumptions that they're making.
It's not assumptions. It's a question of what are you conditioning on. I mean, I'm saying the only interesting counterfactual query is condition on observed outcomes as well as observed interventions.
That may be true. I'm not actually sure that's always the case. So you're saying...
That was too strong. I said not the only ones, but I think typically they're more interesting.
Yeah,
and
actually,
I just wanted to confirm that wouldn't make any difference to anything you've done.
Well, it wouldn't. I mean, it would certainly be handled. The problem with counterfactuals that condition on observed outcomes and hypothetical outcomes is they're typically not identifiable without stronger assumptions. Like, you need to assume monotonic functions or something like
right.
that. So it's actually a different counterfactual, right? So.
Okay, can I follow up your typically? I mean, are there cases that you're aware of where such a counterfactual, which conditions on the fact, you know, that I have in this world observed the outcome of my actual intervention, are there cases, you know, of where that a relevant counterfactual could be identifiable?
Right. So in general, they're not identifiable, and that's not hard to show. I mean, I could just give counterexamples. So two models, they agree on all experimental distributions, but they disagree on this counterfactual.
Right.
So in general, the problem is done there. Of course, in practice, again, if you make assumptions on the function, then you need to identify. So, for example, in linear case, I think it's all identifiable.
In which one?
In a linear model, in linear Gaussian model.
Oh, right.
Because
but in the purely non-parametric, if you've got nothing but the graphical structure,
which
is all you're dealing with, you couldn't do it.
Not only can I not do it, but I can prove that nobody could do it because it's just not identifiable. So. Because I can just give explicit counterexamples. So you have, if you agree on experiments but disagree on the counterfactual, you can't use experiments to compute the counterfactual. There's just no way you can do it algorithmically.
Well, that sounds interesting. I was wondering, we were since you're organizing a number of challenges, we were trying to think about ways of possibly benchmarking counterfactual problems. But it sounds like it's going to be very difficult, in particular in light of the fact that most of them cannot be identified. How about, you know, this problem that has a lot of practical interest in marketing, where people do a marketing campaign and observe the outcome of that marketing campaign or multiple marketing campaigns and observe the outcome. And they would like to know, you know, for example, had they done nothing, would that have changed the sales?
Right. I mean, it depends exactly on how it's formalized. I think if you formalize it as two hypothetical worlds with both observed outcomes, then I don't think, well, I should qualify. If you have conflicting actions and both outcomes are observed, then there's not much you can do, I'm afraid. I believe.
You wouldn't have both outcomes observed. You could only observe an outcome in one world.
Oh, yeah. Then, then it depends on the graph. So if you still have a nasty graph, that would prevent identification. Like if you have the bull arc between what you want to do and what you want to observe and nothing else, then that's kind of difficult. There's not much you can do there. But if you have mediating variables and things you can condition on, sense covariates, things like that, then it may be possible. Like that's sort of the content of the paper. You can figure out precisely what in what graph is possible and not using running this algorithm. And of course, the algorithm itself is again polynomial, so it's not very well optimized, but it is polynomial. So should be efficient.
Jean-Philippe, do you have any comment on question on that in light of the data set you are preparing for marketing?
Well, not really, because one of the goals of these data sets was, to try and see what people would come up with to solve this task. So we're not sure about the feasibility or the golden path to solve this problem.
Perhaps you want, anyways, to submit the protocol to Ilya to see whether he has some, objections in terms of feasibility of the task.
Mm-hmm. That might sound like a good idea. Would you agree to review a formal description of the task to say whether or not it would seem like a good task to submit to people?
Sure. Yeah. Just send it over.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
No problem.
I'll send it tomorrow because it's getting a bit late here in this part of the world.
Ah, sorry.
Well, not so late, but late enough that I have to run.
Okay.
Well, thank you, everyone, for participating. It was an exciting talk and also a very exciting discussion.
Thank you very much, Ilya. I learned a lot.
Thanks. Thanks for coming.
And I'll keep you posted for next talks. I think Dmitry Margaritis is talking next week. So bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.